Hi, folks. You're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire radio podcast. There's a member version, and it gives you 2 hours more of content that you can listen to every week. We just had a great victory in Alabama this week, where Doug Jones obviously beat Roy Moore. Folks, going forward, we're going to see more and more of the right wing create this alternate parallel narrative that is going to be a direct assault on, frankly, reality. We need your help to continue to tell the truth week in, week out. If you enjoy the show, if you want to hear more, become a member. Head over to rofpodcast.com. Become a member. You can do it for literally a couple of bucks a week, and you will get the full show, plus access to all our archives, and you will provide us with the revenue so that we can stay on the air and producing a podcast each week. rofpodcast.com. For those of you who are members, thanks so much. Really appreciate it. For those of you who aren't, check out and see what you're missing. Sit back, enjoy the show. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Today on Ring of Fire, Rebecca Klein from HuffPo will join us to discuss the dangers of voucher schools and why Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos is all in. Ryan Cooper will stop by to talk about his new report that details the disproportionate loss of black wealth under the Obama administration. Heather Digby Parton from Salon will be here to break down the special election in Alabama, and attorney Julia Olson will join us to discuss the Trump administration's effort to block a major climate lawsuit. Don't forget, you can go to rofpodcast.com and sign up for the free one-hour version of the Ring of Fire radio podcast. And if you want the full show, commercial-free, become a member. That's the best way to support this program. That's rofpodcast.com. Podcast.com. Here to help me run down some of the biggest headlines of the week, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her, Digby. So Digby, we have some pretty good news this week. Of course, in Alabama, the Democrat, Doug Jones, did something that no Democrat's been able to do in a statewide office, never mind the Senate, in at least 10 years in Alabama. That is beat the Republican. And so Doug Jones, now the senator from Alabama, beats the Republican Roy Moore. And going into this election, if somebody had told me that Roy Moore was going to win by 10 points, I would have said, okay, that makes sense. And if somebody had told me that Doug Jones was going to win by 10 points, I would have said, yeah, okay, that makes sense. There was really no way to know what was going on there. Polls were all over the place. There was no polls that really nailed it, but it's a good outcome. And there's a lot of fallout from this.
Oh, it's huge. I mean, I think the last Democratic senator who won in Alabama was in 1992, and that was Richard Shelby, who immediately switched to the Republican Party. I think he did it like the next day. It was that extreme. Maybe it was 94, but it was, you know, one of those years or in the early 90s. And that was it. And of course, Richard Shelby is still the Republican senator from Alabama, and he, you know, quite ostentatiously over the weekend. I mean, he had not been for Roy Moore and then came out over the weekend and pretty much said, you know, we can do better than this. I'm not voting for him. I am going to write somebody else in. And of course, there were quite a few write-in votes in Alabama, presumably most of them against Roy Moore, people who would have, you know, theoretically anyway, been Republicans. The state is very, very Republican and voted for someone other than Roy Moore because they couldn't stomach it. I mean, you know, there are a number of factors that happened here. I mean, this, if you look at the analysis that's coming out throughout the week. I mean, it pretty much shows the same thing happened there that happened in Virginia, although Virginia is a swing state.
Right.
And Alabama is hardcore conservative. But nonetheless, it was the same coalition that came out and voted for Doug Jones. It was, you know, it was a huge, you know, really enthusiastic turnout of African Americans, which in a state like Alabama is really, really important because it's, you know, it's a big population. Most, you know, I don't think people really think about this, but it's true. You know, the biggest populations of African Americans in the country are still in the South. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. they're a minority, but it's 30% of the population in Alabama. It is a big faction and very, very decisive if they all come out and vote. And they did this time, thanks to
I don't mean to be a stickler, but it's 27%. And the only reason why I say that is because they made up 29% of the voting population. So the black turnout in Alabama was massive and nearly what it was in the general election, which is, you know, this is a special election, but continue.
Yeah, I mean, this is truly important. And, you know, I think we can all understand why African-Americans think it's important to vote against people like Roy Moore and, you know, vote for someone like Doug Jones, who I think, you know, had a very credible case to make to the African-American community. He ran as a mainstream liberal with a lot of, you know, very liberal ideas about economics and social issues, and was known as the man who prosecuted the KKK members who blew up that church back in the 1960s, killing 4 little African-American girls. And, you know, I don't think people have talked enough about the symbolism of that. I mean, that is really an amazing thing, that the guy who prosecuted that case against the KKK in Alabama is now the senator. I don't think that's something I would have thought was possible, but it was, and largely due to this massive African-American turnout. But it wasn't just that. It was also these suburban, white, college-educated voters who presumably most of them had voted Republican in the last election, or there may have been some who just stayed home and went, you know, it's not worth it to me to vote.
Particularly women.
Particularly women. And I think we understand why that might be. I mean, let's not forget that Roy Moore's reputation, you know, he was always known as an extremist. He had this, you know, reputation, you know, he had been kicked off the state Supreme Court twice, and everybody knew what he was. But that level of hypocrisy of a man who sold himself as this very super righteous, you know, conservative Christian soldier turns out to be something, you know, of a deviant who basically in his 30s had been stalking and molesting underage girls. And I think that for a lot of women, you know, many of whom had voted for Trump and may be having regrets about that as well, maybe said, you know what, I can't do it. So that coalition, which is a lot of all the young people voted for Jones, a large African-American turnout, and then these suburban white voters, particularly college-educated voters, particularly women, that coalition is holding up. It's the same coalition that turned out in Virginia and other states a month ago, and now did it in a place like Alabama, which kind of shows that there's something kind of structural going on here, that there's something actual, you know, a coalition that actually it goes beyond whatever, you know, parochial, regional, or statewide concerns might be in these individual races. Because you wouldn't normally see that a state like Alabama and, say, a state like New Jersey would have that much in common, but they did. The turnout for these special elections is the same coalition of people. So this is encouraging, I think, for Democrats on a number of different levels. And, you know, it means that, you know, that the Democratic donors poured a ton of money into Alabama, a lot. And maybe this will loosen up that money for 2018 as well. It's going to be necessary. This is, you know, people act like it's a given at this point that Democrats are going to win the 2018 midterm. But that's not, you know, it's hard.
Right.
Because they have got, I mean, the gerrymandering in the House and then the Senate, the burden that they have to face in the Senate is really high. Not impossible. I'm quite hopeful. But nonetheless, it's going to take a lot of money and a lot of organizing and a lot of effort. So this is just one more bit of evidence that maybe the Democratic coalition and Democratic donors and maybe even the party is getting its act together to actually challenge this, you know, this
what we're dealing with
that
here.
We have. Yeah.
Well, look, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, let's talk about some of the specifics that we saw in terms of the DNC and other groups, what they did in Alabama. Let's talk about why, if it is the case that we're seeing the sort of same demographic, I guess, coalition and wave that is carrying it. Let's try and tease out how much of that is a function of Roy Moore being a predator and an extreme guy, and how much that's offset by Alabama being one of the reddest, if not the reddest state in the country. And what's going to happen around the country for this to carry through in 2018. We got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We're talking to the great Digby, Heather Parton. Hey folks, Mike Papantonio's new book entitled Law and Vengeance, which is the follow-up to his critically acclaimed novel Law and Disorder, is finally out and available to you to buy. The book is a legal and political thriller drawing on Pap's experience both as a skilled trial lawyer and as a nationally syndicated political talk show host. The story follows trial lawyer Gina Romano, who was first introduced in Law and Disorder, on her quest for both vengeance and justice in a whistleblower lawsuit against a weapons manufacturer who developed and sold a dangerously defective rifle scope. Papp has built a story around real-life events that he's encountered as one of the top trial lawyers in America, where he's been fighting some of the world's largest and most corrupt corporations. Buy Mike Papantonio's new book, Law and Vengeance, today. Go to www.lawandvengeance.com. That's lawandvengeance.com. Check it out. I know you're going to love it. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar, here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Digby, when we broke, we were talking about, obviously, Doug Jones winning a big, well, not by a big margin, but it was a massive victory in Alabama. I have to chuckle a little because I was watching Doug Jones's acceptance speech, or victory speech, I guess, and I thought it was a pretty good speech. He started out with, you know, we've come together, we've unified, and I just thought, man, this couldn't exhibit more polarization than what we're seeing in this election tonight. But nevertheless, he won. It's a really important victory. We'll talk about the import of the victory outside of electoral politics in a bit, but I want to just touch on where we left off in the last segment when you were talking about this coalition of essentially suburban, particularly college-educated, particularly women, and African-Americans, particularly African-American women, but broadly speaking, African-American turnout was quite huge. And we can talk about what drove that, obviously, having a voting against a guy who perceives slavery as really an institution that brought families together will motivate some people. But there was a tremendous amount of organizing on the ground. One of the questions, though, is can you translate this to other places? You know, it's tough to disaggregate. How much of this was because Roy Moore was a right-wing fanatic in the context of Alabama? He probably wasn't that much of a right-wing fanatic. But, you know, child predator is definitely going to hurt you. But there is this quality, it seems to me, in Alabama that was at play here, which is that Doug Jones had a chance, right? And the fact that he had a chance made it easier to drive people out to the polls, because that's not typically the case in Alabama. And these things start to become a self-fulfilling prophecy, because Now, anybody who's thinking, like, I'm not going to go out. I live in a red state. My congressperson's not going to win. This guy's been in the Congress for 10 years. There's no way he's getting out. The argument becomes pretty easy as to why you should go out and vote. Doug Jones just won in Alabama. You know, nothing is impossible in this context. And I have a feeling that's going to activate a lot of people who wouldn't otherwise vote to go out and vote, on top of, of course, all these other issues.
Well, I hadn't thought about that, but I think you may be right. You know, just the idea that it's possible sort of penetrates this, you know, the polarization in a sense. You know, part of polarization is that, you know, the two extremes, they're at loggerheads, and the sort of people who are, you know, they're busy, they're living their lives, whatever, they figure, what the hell? Politics isn't relevant to me. It's already been settled here in this, you know, where I live. That's what, you know, determines who's going to win. So the idea that somebody has it, like Doug Jones has a chance, I think is truly useful. That may be something that is sort of going to be carrying us through, hopefully, through next fall, and then, you know, hopefully beyond into 2020, assuming that Trump is still president and is going to run again, which he says he is. So, you know, this could, it's important, I think, especially, you know, after a loss like last November, the idea that people came on the ground, and we haven't really talked about this, but I think it's really important. Down in Alabama, one of the things that happened was that the African-American community really got organized. And a lot of it was led by the NAACP down there and a number of other African-American organizations, supplanted and helped by the Democratic National Committee, the Democratic Senatorial Committee, and, you know, outside groups, all of whom came together to try and organize around this race. I mean, for obvious reasons, but also I think because, you know, they feel empowered. There's something happening on the ground with this coalition of Democrats. You know, it happened in Virginia. I think, you know, the idea that a lot of those races that were won there were powered by women who, you know, came out, you know, in absolute defiance of what had happened the previous November and just going, no, we're not going to take this anymore. We've got to get out there and actually do something. And that, as you say, that sort of builds on itself, right? You know, this feeling that, you know, yeah, we can make a difference. Look, it did in Virginia. Look at the African-American community organizing itself down there in Alabama. This is possible. This is something that we can actually do. And, you know, that it's amazing that that's happened because, you know, we've had such a, I don't know, politics has seemed distant for a long time, I think, for Democrats. Yes. Even though everybody loved Barack Obama, it was a very top-down kind of situation. He was the big leader. Everybody loved him. They wanted him to be president. But there was no sense of actual personal investment. You know what I mean? Like, I got to get out there. I'm going to go to that meeting. I'm going to do some canvassing. I'm going to pick up the phone and call. You know, those kind of things. I think it's different. What's happening here is it's not about a person. It's not about a particular leader. It's about trying to, you know, build this kind of grassroots personal investment in politics. And, you know, that's a very encouraging sign, I think. I mean, I think it's better that way. I think that's how maybe they'll be able to, you know, Democrats will be able to, around the country, maybe deliver a serious message to, you know, Donald Trump and to the Republicans and to the media and the, you know, the elitist political establishment in general, which is, you know, hey, you know, we're you know, they always say in these campaigns, we're taking our country back. Well, you know, maybe they're taking elections back. Maybe that's really the better way of putting it.
All right. Well, we got to take a break. If you'll join me in the next hour, we still have a lot more to talk about this because the implications, of course, for potentially on the tax deal, the refusal of McConnell to seat Jones. I mean, all of this, we'll talk about all of this and more in the next hour. In the meantime, we got to take a break. We'll be back, like I say, with Digby in the next hour, but we'll be right back with Ring of Fire in just a moment. I'm Sam Seder. See you in a minute. Coming up, why Black American wealth suffered under the Obama administration. I'm Sam Seder, and you're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. During the housing crash, President Obama had the opportunity to put policies in effect that would have helped millions of Americans who suffered while Wall Street received a bailout. Here to discuss how those policies disproportionately hurt Black Americans, Ryan Cooper, national correspondent at TheWeek.com. So, Ryan, let's talk about the more generic. Let's start with the more generic disastrous policies of the Obama administration as to how it related to those homeowners who were in distress in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. Let's talk about those things that Obama did and didn't work out well or didn't do well before we get to the specific implications for Black wealth and Black home ownership in the country. So take us back to following the 2008 collapse. Barack Obama is the president. He's not even the president-elect that, but ultimately he is. That's where he obviously has some authority. And it goes from there. I mean, his earliest decisions, even I think before he became president, were problematic.
Yeah, actually, he was involved with the negotiations because, you know, Democrats were passing this huge bailout because Democrats had the House at least in 2008, and they had their eye on probably winning the presidency. So one of the things they did with the TARP bailout bill, Emergency Economic Stabilization Act of 2008, was they gave the president a huge legal latitude and a big appropriation, which wasn't even specified, basically a huge slush fund to help homeowners who are in distress, with the eye that, you know, Obama is going to be it, and so we're going to give him a ton of authority to deal with this. You know, it's sort of the explicit, you know, justification was that, you know, banks are getting all this massive free money, so, you know, homeowners should get a piece of that too. And basically, you know, we can get into the details, but I think the fundamental thing was that housing prices declined a lot, and there were a ton of assets that had been made out of home mortgages. And so when, you know, there's a big bubble pops, then the question is, who's going to take the hit? Who's going to eat the loss? And the banks were bailed out. All their losses, they were mostly made whole by the government, by ultimately, you know, the taxpayers and the, you know, the state structure created by, you know, the citizenry. But homeowners just ate the losses. For the most part, those are the people that took the hit. It was homeowners on both sides.
I just want to map this out for folks because we can go a little bit further into the weeds insofar as we had all these home mortgages. They were then issued by a servicer who is basically, you know, in charge, or I should say an originator.
Yeah.
And the originator could be a bank or may have been just a service. They then sold it to another bank, and then that bank would have taken it and divvied up these different mortgages and put them into investment vehicles. This is what is known as financial innovation. And these things became derivatives. And each time you get further away from the underlying asset, it's a derivative. And it basically becomes a series of side bets. And when these side bets failed, essentially, because it was incredibly complicated. Some of these side bets were actually insurance that the other side bet wouldn't fail. And when these side bets failed, because the standards for these originators in terms of who they were giving mortgages to and under what conditions, they were making bad loans. And there were so many bad loans that the financial system collapsed. And when the financial system collapsed, it completely undercut home value. So people who had bought a home for $100,000, let's say, suddenly, and they took out a mortgage for $90,000, they put 10% down, they find their house worth $50,000. So even if they were to turn around and sell it, they would owe money once they sold this home. And so they were stuck. And so the question was, how do we bail? How do we help the system? And the Obama administration took that money and gave it to the banks with the idea that the banks would be nice and let the homeowners off the hook, help the homeowners in some way. And let me just remind people, Barney Frank has been saying for years that he was told by Paulson, who was the Treasury Secretary at that time, that I'm happy to give the money directly to homeowners, but Barack Obama has to sign off on it. Barack Obama was the president-elect, and when Barney Frank went to Barack Obama, Obama said, well, we only have one president at a time, and Barney Frank claims that he said, well, frankly, we don't have any presidents right now. and so that was the sort of the first decision. Which way are we going to deal with this problem? We can give it directly to the homeowners and they can pay the banks, or we can give the money and cover the losses for the banks and hope, because there was no mechanism to force the banks to give relief to homeowners. Okay, so that was the first thing. That's TARP. What was the next thing that they did?
Yeah, the next thing is when they set up the supposedly home mortgage, you know, foreclosure relief program. And that was called the Home Assistance Mortgage Program, I think, or HAMP. And they basically, as you were saying, with the bailout money, they gave that money to the banks, you know, and they even nationalized some institutions like AIG, the biggest insurer in the world. But when the Obama people's administration set up a foreclosure relief package, they allocated $75 billion, $50 billion from the bailout money and 70 or 25 from Fannie and Freddie. And they gave that money to the mortgage servicers instead of to the homeowners again. And the servicers are, you know, sometimes parts of these banks, but they're just the sort of accounts receivable department, because as you say, you know, these mortgages are often owned by weird investors all over the globe, and so they hire servicers to handle the paperwork. But the problem with paying the servicers to do loan modifications, supposedly, is that the servicers have a direct monetary incentive not to do loan modifications. Because, you know, as you say, if you're like a underwater homeowner, if you owe more on your house than it's worth, then probably the best thing that can be done for you is a principal reduction, to say, like, you, we're going to cut whatever you owe down to the, you know, actual value of the home so that you're not underwater anymore.
And we should say, you know, this is something that happens in bankruptcies all the time. And in fact, there was a bankruptcy bill in the summer of 2009 where Barack Obama had promised to include a cram down provision. And this is a term of a common term in the context of bankruptcies, where the principal is reduced to basically, you know, everybody says, I mean, because banks have a fiduciary responsibility to loan responsibly. That's why we have bank regulators. That's why there's board of directors who oversee loan officers. That's why they're called officers, for gosh sakes.
Yeah.
And when they make a bad loan, everybody takes a haircut and the principal is pushed down, and that's a cram down. And that, of course, there was no incentive for servicers to do a cram down because they get paid based upon the principal.
Yeah. And then they get paid with fees, and they even have an incentive to foreclose in many cases, because they get paid due to how the servicer contracts are written. They get paid from the proceeds of the foreclosure sale before anybody else, before the investors who own the loan anyways. And it resulted in this crazy situation where they, you know, the servicers were blatantly abusing the program. you know, they were tricking people into foreclosure. It probably made things worse on net, but the Treasury Department didn't investigate really any of the abuses. Neither did the Justice Department, and they didn't even claw back their payments permanently. Like, they took back some for the most outrageous scams they had been running, but they eventually gave them back whenever, you know, they had supposedly made some reforms. But the whole thing was just an epic botch. And the reason it was an epic botch was because the administration did not want to help homeowners. Neil Barofsky was in the room where Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner told Elizabeth Warren that the whole point of this foreclosure program was to foam the runway, his words, foam the runway for the banks.
In other words, a soft landing for the banks, and however they could achieve that, that was the first and last goal. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about the now that we've established the Obama administration had banks in mind, let's talk about who suffered the most severe, deepest consequences of this failure of the Obama administration to deal with this in a proper way. We got to take a quick break. I'm talking to Ryan Cooper on how Barack Obama destroyed black wealth. We'll be right back. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking with Ryan Cooper about his piece in Jacobin Magazine, How Obama Destroyed Black Wealth. So Ryan, when we broke, you had basically walked us through the most relevant aspects of the Obama administration's response to the financial crisis, and particularly what it did to the housing market. And there were two basic major players in the housing market, homeowners and the banks and servicers and all the people who were on the other side of that loan. And the Obama administration bailed out the banks. And there was, I think, you know, to be fair, they thought this will probably help homeowners. And but they didn't have much invested in it by any measure. Their follow-up, their planning, it was all secondary, and that was sort of an if-come, that would be nice type of situation. So let's talk about who suffered in this situation, because Americans, when we look at wealth inequality, it is so pronounced in this country because home ownership is one of the primary means in which to pass down wealth in this country, if not the primary means. And when we look at the wealth disparity in this country, we see a massive disparity between whites and blacks.
Yes, and it was very large before the crisis, which was the result of, you know, as is pretty common knowledge now, you know, black people, they were last in terms of getting access to, you know, the classic New Deal home mortgage subsidies and the federal loan insurance for mortgages to, you know, build up that, you know, your classic middle class nest egg, which is a paid off house. That's where the vast bulk of middle class wealth is, such that it exists. And, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, they got nothing, pretty much. You know, any integrated or black neighborhood was pretty much disqualified from federal home loans. A lot of people were horribly abused. It was somewhat taken back, but even during the subprime bubble, black families were getting disproportionately in subprime mortgages, both because they tend to be poor, make less money than white people, and also because of racism. You know, a lot of black middle-class families who would have qualified for a regular mortgage were tricked deliberately often into subprime loans because there's big demand for those things. And there's a Wells Fargo whistleblowers testified that they tricked these middle-class black families that they called mud people into ghetto loans that were, you know, just to feed into the securitization sausage machine, basically. And so they were already not doing so well before the crisis, but after the crisis, once again, black people took it on the chin the most. You know, they're just like at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder. And so, you know, probably most black families have basically no wealth. You know, they have like a family car, but like that doesn't even count as wealth, really. It's more of a consumption good in most cases. But the families that do have wealth, middle-class families, it's mostly housing. So you look at basically who did the worst wealth-wise after the financial crisis, and it was middle and upper middle-class black people who just took it right on the chin. You know, very rich people they have most of their wealth in stocks, and stocks have completely come back. So the top 2% of black families have more than recovered their previous position. And they've actually had a net positive in terms of wealth. But even just below that, the 97th richest, black families in the country just got crushed, you know, losing into the hundreds and even over $200,000 in wealth for people well into the black upper class, you know. And this is places like Prince George's County, like places that have been very solidly, you know, upper middle class, upper class black communities with like a solid, you know, foundation. And they just got hammered by this policy failure. So reported accounts of Prince George's County in particular, but other black communities around the country, they saw that the foreclosure crisis, it hit those places really hard, and it kept going long past it when it was finished in white communities. And the most shocking statistic that we discovered in calculations from the Survey of Consumer Finances was that the percentage of black homeowners who were underwater in their mortgage increased by over 2,000% from 2007 to 2013. It went from 0.7% to over 14% of black homeowners who were underwater. And, you know, it was just like those are the people who are being, when you say foam the runway, those are the people who are being crushed by the bank, you know, jumbo jet as it's landing.
That is landing. People understand what that means. That means that those people cannot move. They cannot pursue work. If they sell their home, they're going to owe money, which means that they cannot move to another, you know, they can't buy another house. So they've lost all of that wealth. There's every reason, you know, so the implications of this are so dramatic and ripple out. All right. Look, we only have a minute left, so we're not going to get to you guys both did a full report. That you put over at the People's Policy Project website. And you've written this piece in the Jacobin, but you also outline how things could have been better. And broadly speaking, it would have been just to provide direct assistance to the homeowners. If we had made the homeowners either able to pay their mortgage or cram down the principal, everybody would have taken a small haircut. The banks would have been fine because at least their assets that weren't over leveraged and derivatized and innovatized would have been fine. And you would have had homeowners, and the economy would have come back probably a lot quicker as well. And there was perfect precedent from this from the New Deal era. People are going to have to go to Jacobin and check this out because we're out of time. But Ryan Cooper, I really appreciate it. Fascinating stuff. And I'm glad you pulled all this work together.
Thanks for having me.
Ryan Cooper is a national correspondent at TheWeek.com. His work has appeared in The Washington Monthly, The New Republic, and The Washington Post. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Seder. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Check out ROFpodcast.com to support the show. I've been-
been rolling on the freeway. I've been fighting 85. I've been thinking way too much, and I'm way too gonna drive.